From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Detroit's casinos are allowed to reopen under strict new guidelines. Those rules don't extend to the state's tribal casinos, but they're already on the case.
You know, we want to make sure we, you know, kind of had our legs underneath us before, you know, opening fully to the public.
The CEO of Soaring Eagle joins us today. We'll also speak with a grocer who doesn't plan to reopen while COVID-19 is still a public health threat.
I work with my mom, and it's just two of us right now. In order to keep everything isolated. You know, if somebody gets sick, if my mom gets sick, like, what good is money?
And we'll get into Detroit's history with punk rock.
It became a place where sort of the freaks, the outsiders, the weirdos all came together. Because you have to remember, in that period in the 1970s, it was singer-songwriters, it was prog rock, it was big arena rock, and it just wasn't speaking to these folks.
Those conversations and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, we check in with former Michigan radio reporter Bryce Huffman. He started working for Bridge Detroit, a newsroom made up entirely of people of color, just days before George Floyd was killed by police and Black Lives Matter protests took hold around the globe.
I'm really fortunate to be in a newsroom where I don't have to explain my experience to anyone. It's very much understood.
But first, when the coronavirus hit, businesses all across Michigan were forced to retool or close their doors. Now, as some of those businesses begin to reopen, there's one Asian grocery store in Ann Arbor that has decided not to. Jason Pong is the owner, and he joins us now. Hey, Jason, welcome to Stateside.
Hello, thank you for having me.
For starters, will you tell us just a little bit about the store and what kind of things you retail?
Yeah, we're we call it Asian grocery store, but mostly we focus on Korean products, and we're in Ann Arbor. In the midst of this whole COVID thing, we sort of celebrated our 10th year anniversary. And I don't know, we couldn't get people in the parking lot and have just like a drive-through party. So we just kind of let it slide.
Yeah, I think celebration is kind of get it where you can these days.
Exactly. And sometimes, you know, the celebrating for the sake of it kind of makes you feel a little back to normal. And we do what we can.
Right. I understand you have been taking online orders. How's that going?
It's very clunky, and I really appreciate our customers for putting up with it, because we were never any kind of e-commerce store. There are certain factors with the type of the store that we run. It's just really difficult to do it that way.
Is that because the range of products can vary from month to month?
No, products are pretty similar, but it's just the store itself, when it was founded, was built on a brick-and-mortar model, and our square footage costs and the way the retail space works doesn't work as well for online. And on top of everything else, we have to build an infrastructure just for that. And being a mom-and-pop shop, or as I call it, mom-and-son shop,
right,
it's tougher to just pull time away from work to work on this. And, you know, as much as I like being at work, wink, wink, it's when you go home, you really don't want to dedicate another 3-4 hours in building this infrastructure. And looking back, maybe I should have, but meh, that's what it is.
Right. On your Facebook page, you've posted that the store will not be open until there's a significant reduction of COVID-19 cases. Can you talk about what the deciding factors will be for you as you look at that?
You know, this state of Michigan declared emergency back on March 10th, I believe. And the treatments for COVID, I don't think has changed all that much. We're obviously making progress in different medicines that could be worked. But luckily for me, the diverse customer base allows me to speak to different people. And because of the fact that I'm taking email orders, I speak to them about orders. And then sometimes they tell me if they're in medical profession, because I do give them priority because I figured they're frontline workers. But so I get curious and I ask them like, hey, what's the process like and how things are. And one of the upshots is the fact that number of patients being admitted is down. But even still, right now, we don't have a cure. And I feel like every time you go out, you're taking on risk. And sometimes it's calculated risk for people, and other times people just don't think about it. But fact remains, if you get sick, and it's not a horrible odds of getting sick, but if you get sick, the treatment is, well, take Tylenol until your fever just keeps running. And then you come into the hospital, we'll give you 100% oxygen. And if that doesn't work, we'll put you on a ventilator. Now, don't quote me on this because I'm not an expert on this, but that's just my layman's thought on it. And I work with my mom, and it's just two of us right now. You know, if somebody gets sick, if my mom gets sick, like, what good is money? And just because we're essential doesn't mean we get priority in treatment either. It's just basically a crapshoot. And, well, before all this happened, I pretty much foregone the cost of making money during this time. And I consider COVID this huge storm. And after the storm raging outside, you know, you got to buckle down and make sure you can survive.
As you've been telling your customers that when they come for a no-contact delivery, if they ask and you tell them, you know, we're not really planning to reopen, or in terms of the posts that you've made on the Facebook page, what kind of responses have they had to that?
It's been interesting. Well, our email system is very clunky, so I've been getting a lot more calls now that state decided to open up regarding, hey, can we come into the store? And I get a few calls a day or more. And when I tell them, oh, I'm sorry, we're just going to take email orders. And when I ask them, hey, do you need the email address? And they're like, nope, we're good. They hang up. And I can understand from people's point of view, especially when they don't think COVID is this big issue, then they don't see the fuss. They don't see the reason for the fuss. And so I almost wonder if it's their way of trying to pressure us to, you know, we're not going to shop with you unless you open, so you better open up. And on the other end, I'm like, well, it's still not as safe as you think you are, so we're still going to stay the course and see how this goes.
Sure. You know, Jason, you mentioned that the whole business was built on a retail sales model. Do you think if you don't see, you know, if there's no vaccine within the next, say, 9 months, and if the number of cases hasn't shown the kind of change that you're looking for, have you considered retooling the business from here on out?
Well, if COVID told us anything, long-term outlooks don't really do anything for you because you could be broadsided.
Sure.
But you always have to plan ahead. And as of right now, the other part of the equation of selling to the customers is also receiving stock. You know, most of the places, and I think due to the fear of it, especially in America, we don't contact trace. And one of the reasons is because you don't want to be known as the place where people got sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had two of my major vendors shut down for more than a couple weeks. They don't tell you the reasons, but I mean, why else would you shut down in a boom economy for them? And so if the warehouse shuts down and the product itself that we get is kind of sketchy to a degree, although for the most part, you know, I don't think there's been a case of anyone getting infected off of a surface contact, but it's still scary. And like one of the things that's nice about what we're doing that basically traded in way of making money is the fact that when we come home, we just shower and you could just go to sleep instead of having to worry about, dang, you know, like at 2 o'clock when that customer sneezed, they were kind of close to me. Like, is this, and I'm kind of running a fever. Is this it? Like, you don't have to worry about that stress.
Sure.
But going back to your original question, getting stuck into the store is also kind of a scary prospect. So it's really tough. And, you know, in some sense, and as a store owner or as any kind of a business owner, you hate to think about that ultimatum button of like, well, should we consider closing down? But it really needs to be on the table. And obviously, we're going to struggle as much as we can to avoid that if possible. But, you know, if it's your life on the line, I mean, is making X amount of money more important? I just have to get to that point to make that decision. And nobody could just be like, yeah, 6 months from now, we're going to be good.
Right.
We're not. And as Dr. Fauci said, you know, the virus determines the timetable.
Yeah. Have you done the math on how long you can afford to sort of be in limbo like this?
I don't want to think about it.
That's fair.
You know, it's, I mean, I look at the checking account that we got, and PPP sort of helped, but you know, it's not really. PPP was more for helping out employees than actual business establishments. The new reform that they did might help, but then I haven't really read into it. But yeah, as the numbers go down, it's like, yeah.
Well, it's like you say, there's still that long-term viability question regardless.
Yeah. And you know, as weird as it sounds, though, luckily, because the fact that we're a grocery store, we don't have to go out to shop. So we just eat our own stock, I guess. And hope for the best.
Is there anything else that you would hope people would understand about the decisions that you've made?
It's a difficult thing because I think due to the fact that we have so many people that have caught the disease or the virus, but you have this like big number that you don't really think about. But then if you don't have family members or if you don't have friends that are sick, then, you know, to some, it's not a big deal. And I think that's where the disconnect is. Yeah, it makes sense because if you're younger, then you could potentially recover from it or not even have any symptoms. But it spreads without you even knowing it. And the other thing that's really interesting, though, is masks. And I think, especially in America, we were a little behind in trying to get the masks out there because of reasons like not having enough N95s. But just a lot of people don't understand how to use it correctly. I'm kind of done sitting on a soapbox or standing on a soapbox to tell people, hey, don't do this or do that, because A, I'm not an expert, but I got to a point of you start to sound like a broken record, so I'll just let people do what they do outside the store, and we'll just, you know, try to stay safe when we can and let the storm pass.
Yeah. Jason Bang has been talking to us from his family's Asian grocery store. Jason, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this. And we wish you and your family and the business all the best and hope you can find a way to reopen at some point.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we'll see what happens, right?
Right.
Hopefully COVID would be nice to us, but I mean, we got to survive.
Yeah.
And see how it goes. Thank you for your time.
You too. Up next, the music that made Detroit an indelible part of punk history.
You know, you listen to some of them and you go, man, like, why didn't that get further? What, you know, what was it in that period? And there's just some of them that I know could have been, you know, radio hits.
That's after the break. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan occupies so many chapters in America's musical history. Mark at least one of those chapters for the gloriously loud and messy stories of Detroit's punk scene.
Chicks, cars, so American.
Detroit writer and music journalist Rob St. Mary has just finished producing a new two-disc set of music called The End of Night, 1967 to 1983, from the Detroit Punk Archive, which Rob maintains. This collection is a fast and furious introduction to the scene. If you were there, you'll hear bands you know, like The Mutants here. But Rob also uncovered some previously unpublished recordings and stories. Rob St. Mary, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Rob, when people hear about Detroit punk, maybe especially people outside the region, I think their minds probably go straight to the MC5 or the Stooges. But for the purposes of this project, that's not actually what you're talking about.
Well, the thing for me is there's really kind of three eras. And I think some people, as you say, look at the late 60s, what I would call proto-punk bands, or they go to the early 80s and they talk about the hardcore scene. So it's Negative Approach, the Necros, things like that, the stuff that happened around the Freezer scene, both of which are amazing scenes. And they've both been written about extensively. But I always kind of felt that there was a scene that was in there in between that kind of got lost. And partly, I think that has to do with the fact that there were really no big breakout bands. There was one band that came out of that scene. And that would be the Romantics, and they don't really represent the totality of the sound. And as with any sort of creative scene, there's really not one sound. So I think that might be part of it, part of the reason why it is kind of overlooked. So the period that I look at is basically right around 76, 77 through to the early 80s. There's a little bit of an overlap with the hardcore scene, but the hardcore scene is its own thing. I'm mostly focused on this late 70s period, and specifically the bands that came through a place called Bookies Club 870.
Right.
And why that scene was so important.
Could you talk about the club?
Yeah, it's a fascinating place. It was actually the second Cliff Bell's location. So back in the 1940s, it was a jazz supper club, went through a series of owners. And then by 1970, this guy by name of Sam Bookie Stewart bought the place. And Bookie had been, some people say, an illegal bookmaker during Prohibition. And he had been a bar manager for a series of what had been gay clubs since the end of World War II. Brought in some of the first drag shows in the 1950s. And then when he bought this club in 1970 in Palmer Park on the Highland Park border there, it was pretty run down. It was sort of an older gay man's drinking club during the day. And then around February of 78, these kids started coming in and say, hey, can we book the room? Because people won't allow us to play. Most of the bars at the time wanted cover bands. They wanted bands to play basically top 40 hits. And I talked to people who were in the scene and they said, you know, I work on the line all day. The last thing I want to do is be a human jukebox.
Yeah.
So they found this club. They went in there. They started booking it. And within about 6 months, they ended up taking over the entire schedule. And they started bringing in bands from around the area who were locals, as well as well-known national and international acts. So, for example, just looking at the Midwest, you had bands like Pure Ubu and the Cramps, the Dead Boys, John Cale, who was in the Velvet Underground, came and play. You had people from the UK, such as Ultravox. The Police, on one of their first tours when they were in a van, played at Bookies to about 50 people. It's one of those kind of Woodstock stories that everybody says they were there, but really only about 50 people were there to see the Police that night. So it became this club, and what it showed is that there was a real interest in original music, and that opened the door for more venues to open. And actually, the guys who booked Bookies went on to open a place called Clutch Cargos and then opened St. Andrew's Hall, which had been a Scottish Benevolent Society club downtown in Detroit, and turned it into the concert venue we all know it is today.
You alluded to the fact that a lot of the people in these bands had other jobs and, you know, whole other pieces of their lives. What can you tell us about, I mean, this is an incredibly diverse bunch of bands and an incredibly diverse bunch of people in them, but what can you tell us about the lives of the people who played these songs?
It is really a blend. I mean, you've got auto workers, guys who are working on the line. You've got people who are trying to be artists and writers. A lot of them went on, and this was where my interest came in when I did the Orbit book previously, and this whole thing is an offshoot of that, was that a lot of them were writers and artists who eventually went on to do alt publishing, including Orbit magazine. So to me, this is kind of a genesis point for that. It became a place where sort of the freaks, the outsiders, the weirdos all came together, because you have to remember in that period in the 1970s, especially this period, it was singer-songwriters, it was prog rock, it was big arena rock. And it just wasn't speaking to these folks. They were looking for something that wasn't that you didn't have to be a classically trained musician or something like that in order to go on stage and present ideas and songs that matter to you.
You know, you note the fact that there weren't really breakout bands as we understand them in this group, and yet there are fingerprints of people like Wayne Kramer all over some of these tracks. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. You know, Wayne went to prison, which he's talked about, in the mid-70s. And when he got out, he came back to Detroit and he produced two of the tracks that are on the record, one by the Cubes and another by the Cadillac Kids. So he was part of the scene. The thing that I find really interesting about this scene in Detroit was that when we look at, say, the New York scene around CBGB's, a lot of those bands, especially when you talk about the Ramones, I remember Danny Fields talking, who was the manager, who talked about the Ramones, and he said they were four guys who didn't really like each other, but they all liked the Stooges. So other punk scenes, like you look at the Damned's first record, you look at the Sex Pistols' first record, there's covers of Stooges songs on those albums. So these other scenes were really influenced by what had happened before, as we talked about in the late 60s. So these guys actually, this scene in the late 70s, actually featured people who had been in that scene. So you had bands like Destroy All Monsters. You had the bands that Wayne Kramer kind of built and, you know, fell apart. You had Sonic's Rendezvous Band, which was Fred Sonic Smith from the MC5. So there was this crossover of these older folks who were coming into the scene and hanging out with people who were influenced by that, who maybe had saw the Stooges, you know, at their high school or the MC5, you know, or saw them back at the Grandy when they were really young and sneaking into shows. So that influence really does carry over. But at the same time, I think a lot of them were trying to take what was brought by that earlier scene and kind of expand on it. So you see a real range of sound in here. You hear real sort of fast 77 style stuff. You hear things that are obviously not only influenced by the MC5 and the Stooges, but even Alice Cooper. I mean, if you listen to the Sillies, at times it sounds a bit like Alice Cooper. So there's just a really interesting range. And then there's even stuff that I think we wouldn't even call it that yet, but feels more like proto-punk, maybe something like what Public Image Limited would do, or Pere Ubu, or more of the arty.
Just hinting on the edge of new wave there.
Right. And yeah. And then by the time we get to the final tracks that are in here, especially the last one from Mr. Unique and the Leisure Class that finishes the album from 83, that one to me feels like, you know, new wave. It's XTC. It's got this political humor that I think is equal to something like the Dead Kennedys. So, I mean, there's really a range in there that's fascinating. And that's what was so interesting for me about putting it together.
Rob, you pulled this together with funding in part from a Knight Foundation grant, and maybe there's just a touch of dissonance there. Using money like that for a punk archive feels like getting a grant for street art. But what did the money allow you to do that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to?
Sure. I had originally, to kind of tell you the evolution of this, I had put in for a Knight Arts Challenge grant. And originally, I wanted to do it as a book. And some of the people who I'd interviewed for the Orbit book, I had about 50 people, and there was a lot of this stuff that was in the first part of the book that I expanded on. And I thought, well, you know, I'll do kind of a Please Kill Me oral history of just this scene. And Knight came back and said, yeah, we're not really interested in publishing books. You got anything else? And I said, well, how about this? I'll create an archive website where I can host these interviews and stories and everything else that I learn and keep updating it and put out a record set. And they said, sounds great. So I went out and I was able to raise $15,000. They gave me $15,000 towards that. That $15,000 that they gave me went towards building the archive site and working on some other elements of the piece. And then the donations actually went towards creating the record set. So it was kind of a split between the two.
Were there surprises here for you, even as steeped as you are in all this history?
I mean, just the tracks, just finding the tracks and some of the stuff that I was able to find and sort of odd crossover and things like that. So, for example, one of the sort of boombox demos that's in here is with a band called Route 666 that was actually recorded in what is now the Zen Center here in Hamtramck, where I live. It used to be a rehearsal space for bands. And the guy who's the guitarist on that is a guy by the name of Norman Westberg. And Norman Westberg, after Route 666 kind of fell apart, he moved to New York and joined Swans. So he's been in Swans since 1980. So you've got a guy like that who, as I was saying, you know, really steeped in sort of that post-punk New York no-wave scene coming out of here. So I think that's really interesting. I think that, as I talked about earlier, the Mr. Unique song, which has a title that some people said, you know, they kind of looked at me and said, are you sure you want to put that on the record?
We're not going to say it on this family public radio program right now.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. Yeah. I mean, it's not bad. It's called Young, Gifted, and White. And the song is a satire of white privilege run amok. So I tell anyone, I go, to me, when I heard it, it reminded me of things like Kinky Friedman. You know, I've been a fan of his for years. And even the people who wrote for Orbit magazine were satirists. So to me, it's a great satirical piece that it seems only to get better with age, sadly, and hopefully we can move past that period. But it's just so many great tracks on here. And the thing that's really sad to me is that, you know, you listen to some of them and you go, man, like, why didn't that get further? You know, what was it in that period? There's just some of them that I know could have been radio hits. I mean, I think RUR's Go Baby, and I have many people say that to me. They go, that was like the single.
Right.
That's one of the best tracks to come out of this scene.
You mentioned the fact that there was cross-pollination definitely among bands in Detroit and bands in New York, but largely so many of these bands were geographically cut off from the LA scene, the New York scene. When you listen to these tracks, what do you think was the end result of that isolation?
I think that it forced them to be creative in their own manner in which they were going to put the stuff out. So, for example, just being self-funded in terms of putting out the singles or getting a bunch of bands together and chipping in to put comps together or going into places and booking shows, you know, that started the scene. I mean, it really forced them to think creatively and to use that sort of Detroit work ethic in a way. I think another reason why this scene in Detroit in particular didn't have the ability to branch out is that some of the bands were able to tour. So, for example, like Flirt and the Mutants played New York quite a bit. They played Max's Kansas City. I think several of them also played CBGB's. I think the Cult Heroes did as well. But as we know around here, the problem was, you know, the touring infrastructure wasn't there. So there wasn't a lot of money to be made. And obviously being in New York, you had a base for that. You had the media and all of the other things that go along with it. I think here it was a little bit harder to kind of get out of the Midwest bubble and to get the attention, even though Cream Magazine at the time, which was from Detroit, did write about some of these bands. But it just didn't seem to take.
Yeah. Although we should say, like so many of these bands, it really wasn't necessarily about the money for them.
No, it was just about the ability to be able to create, go have a good time. And I think that that's really the takeaway. Like, I've told people that my effort around telling this history, if there's a couple of serious lessons that are in there, it's that you can do it, anyone can do it, and you should do it. I remember Jerry Vile, who does The Dirty Show, who was the guy who published Orbit Magazine, I did the book about. He talked about how he became the singer of the band called The Boners. And he said, look, you know, we saw Iggy and said, if he can do that, so can we. So why not? And that to me, I think, is the lesson. It's like, you don't have to wait for someone to come down and sort of tap you on the shoulder and say, okay, it's your time now. It's like, no, go do it. And I think that's important. I think from a music history here in Detroit, the legacy of venues is really important when we talk about this history, because the fact that the guys who booked Bookies went on to become the guys who took St. Andrews Hall and turned it into a concert venue, a mid-level concert venue, that is huge. Because before then, there was really only local bars, and then there was Kobo or the Masonic Temple. And if you were a local band, there wasn't a lot of room for you, because you were probably not going to be able to sell out 4,000 seats, but you could probably do a bit better than 100.
Yeah.
So, you know, where was the room to have that flexibility? And I think these guys really, when they went into that club in early 78, had no idea that they were going to change the way venues and booking and all of that happens here in the city.
I imagine it's got to be challenging to think about mastering a collection of punk songs. I mean, you don't want them to sound too good. But these sound really great. I see you did them at Third Man Mastering in Detroit by no less than Warren DeFever.
Yeah, Warren's great. His name is alive, going on 30 years right now. If you're not hip to him, I mean, just an amazing musician, amazing sound engineer. Originally on 4AD when he first came out in 1990. Of course, that label gave us bands such as the Pixies and Cocteau Twins and all kinds of great stuff over in the UK. So he's been doing great stuff on his own, but he's one of the master mixers over at Third Man, and I had a Prest over there as well. So I just decided, you know, let's keep it all in Detroit. I had worked on some other vinyl projects also in the past with a label that I have, and I had also worked with the other Detroit pressing plant before, Archer Records, who I have mad respect for Mike Archer and the work he does over there.
It's so tricky to think about mastering and remastering punk records. Because, I mean, there's a lot that you don't want to lose. How did you guys go about it?
Well, the thing is that some of these came from 7-inches that I was able to collect. Probably the most expensive one was the Cult Heroes. I bought a really mint copy on Discogs for about $100 just so I could have that track. I would have to say probably half the record comes off of things that I got my hands on that were 7-inch records or comps, and they had to be pulled from that and then cleaned up a little bit. a lot of the master tapes are gone. Some of these bands, you know, the stuff got thrown out or misplaced or who knows where it is. Some of it was digital. They had transferred it at some point to save it and then to send me files. So Warren just did a really amazing job in helping make it sound really rich and full. And my biggest thing for me was like, how do I put all this together? How do I have it make logical sense? And I had a couple of different rules in terms of how I come up with the tracks and how the track order was going to be. My thing was I didn't want two bands that sounded similar to each other next to each other because I didn't want them to kind of blend into each other and you go, oh, was that the same band twice? No. So there was a couple of rules I had kind of set for myself in terms of how I really wanted this to sound. And they just captured it. I mean, between him and Bill Skibbe, who was the engineer who cut the lacquer plates that eventually the record was pressed from, they just did a fantastic job over there.
The name of this new double album set is The End of the Night. It is 29 tracks from Detroit punk bands circa 1976 to 1983. We've been talking to Rob St. Mary, who pulled the project together. You can learn a lot more at the website that he built, DetroitPunkArchive.com. Rob, thank you so much for doing this, and we can hear all the love that you put into it.
Thank you for taking the time. It means a lot.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, we're going to check in on what's happening at the tribal casino Soaring Eagle with their plans for reopening amid COVID-19. That's after the break, so hang on. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Among the businesses allowed to reopen under new and stricter guidelines are casinos. Detroit casinos have been permitted to resume business with just 15% capacity on the gaming floors. Masks will be required at all times, and there's no smoking allowed. Those specific guidelines do not extend to Michigan's tribal-owned casinos, but many of the casinos have already opened with similar measures in place. And that includes Soaring Eagle Casino of the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe in Mount Pleasant. Mike Bean is the CEO of Soaring Eagle, and he joins us now. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Could you tell us a little bit about what reopening is going to look like?
Sure. You know, we've been closed for 2.5 months. We closed on March 16th. And, you know, during this time, like many others, you know, we spent time trying to understand, you know, and learn about the coronavirus. And, you know, we put together a, you know, health and sanitation plan to responsibly reopen our casinos. And, you know, we have a number of things that we're putting in place. And we're also, you know, having a phased approach. So, you know, the reopening will have things like the buffet will not be open. Valet and coat check will not be operating. You know, we've canceled our summer concert series because of some social distancing challenges in that environment. And then we have, you know, a number of health and sanitation measures we put in place.
Sure. Can you tell me a little bit about what Soaring Eagle is going to be doing to keep employees safe at this time?
Sure. So all team members and guests, for that matter, are required to wear masks. We have temperature checks at all of our guest and our team member entrances. So all team members and guests are temperature checked upon arrival to work every day. You know, we have plexiglass barriers at high interaction areas, such as the Players Club and the cage. And we have plexiglass barriers at table games. And, you know, we have additional hand sanitization stations, we communicate with our team members to talk about, you know, please, you know, wash your hands frequently. And if you don't feel well, you know, please don't come to work, stay home, and follow your medical provider's advice.
Mike, you mentioned that there are certain parts of Soaring Eagle, like the buffet and the concert series, that just won't be happening this year. What about amenities like the water park?
Sure, the water park is open and operating, and our other casinos, the Slot Palace and Saginaw Eagle's Landing, are open as well. And so we're going to, you know, get back to business in those places as well.
Tell me a little bit about the decision to have the initial reopening available for invited guests, a limited number of guests.
Sure. So, you know, not knowing what our business volumes would look like and having put, you know, health and sanitation measures in place for, you know, team members and guests, you know, we wanted to make sure we, you know, kind of had our legs underneath us before, you know, opening fully to the public. So we wanted to do so with, you know, a limited number of guests in the facility to make sure that we could get any kinks out that we needed to.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about another decision that was made, that there would be, I believe, no smoking on the casino floor. Is that right?
Yes, you know, with the requirement of masks, we felt it was prudent to also, prohibit smoking for the time being on the casino floor. We do have designated areas outside of the casinos for smoking, and it's guests are really doing a great job and working with us to wear masks and smoke in designated areas, and so far it seems to be working out well.
Yeah, I don't smoke myself, but I confess, when I have been to casinos, it does add something to the ambience. It's kind of different to think about the experience without that.
Yeah, it is different, and it's noticeable. One of a number of things that are different these days.
Yeah. I was looking at the coverage of some of the casinos that reopened in Las Vegas recently, and casino goers came back in droves. It was, by many respects, a successful reopening. But I did notice that a lot of guests at the Vegas resorts did not wear masks. What kind of expectations do you have about what's going to happen if people choose to come back, but, maybe they're not wearing masks or adhering to social distance?
Sure. Masks are required to be worn at the Saginaw Chippewa Gaming Enterprises, which includes, Soaring Eagle, Saginaw Eagle's Landing out in Standish, and the Slot Palace and Bingo Hall in Mount Pleasant. That's part of our plan. Part of our plan requires team members and guests to wear masks. And of course, we continue to, if we find ways to improve or think that the plan needs to be changed, we will, of course, change it. We've been very fortunate that our guests are working with us and, wearing masks. And, we have had very few problems with that. And so, I think everybody, and we're thankful to our guests for working with us because so far it's working out well.
Why was it important to reopen?
It's a very difficult decision many others throughout the country. We have to balance the economic impact of remaining closed with our readiness to reopen in a responsible manner. And, we got to a point where we felt as though we could reopen in a responsible manner. The economic impact is something that, was also the consideration.
Yeah. Could you say a few words about what the reopening of Soaring Eagle and the revenues that it provides for the tribe, what that's going to mean for life in the region?
Sure. The reopening went well. We're seeing, initially some very strong business volumes. We think a lot of that has to do with, some degree of cabin fever and people really, really just wanting to get out. But the economic impact, for the tribe and the region is material, given, the jobs and given, the purchasing that we do from, local vendors and others. And so, there's an exponential impact of, of the revenue of the casino.
Can you tell me a little bit about what kind of preparations you're making for the long term? I mean, what does the outlook seem like to you for the summer and going into fall?
We're cautiously optimistic. The business volumes have been good. They've been at the pre-closure levels so far, but we do anticipate that will probably flatten out over time. But we're, so far from what we've seen, guests are returning and doing so responsibly. And so, we look forward to the fall and continuing on after that. Hopefully we can get, a vaccine, or some, very significant treatment for the virus and, get past this in a more material way.
How are your lines of communication with public health officials with the state to monitor cases and to get a sense of whether everything is truly going okay with the reopen?
Well, we monitor the websites and try to have an understanding of what's going on out there as much as we can.
Do you know much about where guests to Soaring Eagle come from? What part of the state they originate?
Sure, they come from all over the state, but our geographic market extends typically to points where our guests are equidistant to other casinos. So proximity matters quite a bit in this business. So, you know, we have a pretty broad reach.
I guess in a strange way, you maybe have to keep an eye on infection rates in other parts of the state to have a sense of how it's going, how it might be going for your business, yes?
Yeah, we've been monitoring, you know, all regions, you know, given that we do have a pretty broad market.
Right. Well, Mike Bean, thank you so much for your time and good luck with reopening plans.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That's Mike Bean, the CEO of the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribes Gaming Enterprises, including Soaring Eagle Casino in Mount Pleasant. Something that we've been hearing over the past couple of weeks is that Michigan's been here before. People marching in the streets, African-American citizens standing up against generations of violence and systematic oppression. But this time, sometimes you hear people say there's just more people involved, more energy, more political will. We were curious to get a little deeper into the context. Joining us today is Bryce Huffman, a reporter for Bridge Detroit. In case you had not heard, Bridge Detroit is a new nonprofit journalism project covering the city. Bryce, it's really good to hear from you.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, you grew up in Detroit, and I know that's where you're living now, but listeners might remember your prior job was covering Grand Rapids for Michigan Radio, so you've had a chance to sort of keep an eye on both communities.
Yeah.
Was there anything that you noticed about the protests in Detroit and Grand Rapids, what they shared or ways in which they're different?
I think one of the big similarities I've seen, I guess I'll start with the things that are similar. It's a lot of young people getting involved, a lot of young white people, frankly, getting involved. And that's something that you didn't necessarily see 5 or 6 years ago when the protests happened after Ferguson and after Eric Garner were killed. So that's definitely something that has been seen in both cities. Lots of young college activists, a lot of young 20-somethings getting involved, some for the first time protesting. The difference that I'm seeing is the reaction from the police. In Detroit, there was a few days, maybe 4 or 5 days, where police had sort of an antagonistic relationship with protesters. But in Grand Rapids, there were actual riots. There were actual cop cars being lit on fire. Cops were actually on video beating people up with batons. It seems that the main difference is in Grand Rapids, the police department, they're taking more aggressive action against people who are peacefully protesting. And not that that hasn't happened in Detroit, but it seems that from the top down, the police department is recognizing that the protesters are right and that the police do need some checks and balances put on them.
Yeah. You recently published an article for Bridge Detroit in which you spoke with Black police officers, retired or departed from the force, some of whom had very long experience. Could you say a little bit about who you reached out to for this?
Yeah. One of the names that is kind of famous for his stories as a cop is Ike McKinnon. He was an officer. He was a Black police officer for the force starting in 65. And I want to say he left in 84 and then came back in 94 and was actually chief for a couple of years. The other officer that I spoke to who actually made it into the piece is Laverne Mack. He actually was an officer who, like Ike, joined the force after being brutalized by white police officers. They both joined the force with the intention of changing it from within. And although they both admit things didn't go their way at first, eventually some change actually was seen there.
Yeah. Many of the issues at play in these protests are not new. And both Ike McKinnon and Vern Mack, as you say, had some really harrowing stories to share about their own experiences as young Black men and as young Black police officers. Did they offer any thoughts on what might be different this time around or what they see ahead for police forces in their cities?
I think what they both spoke to isn't necessarily about what is different right now. But what could become different and what is slowly starting to happen more and more as these protests are publicized, it's that people who didn't think that they had skin in the game young, white, educated people from the suburbs, people who, you know, maybe 20, 25 years ago wouldn't protest police brutality because it doesn't affect them. Those are the people that are starting to really get involved and starting to talk to their fellow white neighbors and talk to people who don't think that they have skin in the game. And I think that is some of the change that we're starting to see right now.
This must have been a really incredible moment for them to witness.
I would assume so.
Yeah. This wasn't implicitly addressed in your published piece, but did either of them, or Omari Barksdale, who you also spoke with, who's a community activist in Detroit, did any of them have thoughts on the proposals that we've heard to defund police, the implication being that the institution is fundamentally flawed?
Well, Omari addressed it a little bit, but the other two didn't really address defunding the police, but addressing police departments and fixing them from within. And part of the fixing them from within that they both talked about was having officers that look like and are from the communities of people that they're policing. And I think that's the change that they were really trying to implement when they were on the force. Omari talked about the idea of taking resources from the police department and putting it in the community. And even though that didn't necessarily make it into the published piece, that's something that has been a real talking point this week amongst people in the city is, well, what if we did defund it? What would that look like? Where would those resources go? And would that actually solve the issue here? And the issue is racial injustice. And from what I've heard from people, it doesn't seem like defunding the police would really address that on its head.
It was especially poignant reading what Ike McKinnon had to say about 1967 in Detroit. Could you just share a little bit of what he told you about what was going on with him that year when the city exploded?
Yeah, so Ike McKinnon actually lived in the area where the riots started. And while the story he shared with me wasn't about the riots, it was about the state of mind that police officers had at the time. He shared with me a story where he was in uniform driving his car, and he was pulled over by two white officers. He signaled to them that he was a police officer. He showed them his badge, and they shot at him. And, you know, he luckily got away, but they said some racial slurs to him right before they fired at him. And I think it's things like that that we kind of lose to history when it comes to Detroit. We forget that while we are a predominantly black city now, that wasn't always the case. And the racial tension that he talked about with me is something that a lot of black Detroiters have felt for decades.
Yeah. Bridge Detroit launched just a few days before George Floyd was murdered. This has to be an amazing time to be launching a newsroom populated by reporters of color covering a community that is majority black and brown in this moment. Could you maybe describe a little bit about what that's been like and what some of the conversations have been?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I'm really fortunate to be in a newsroom where I don't have to explain my experience to anyone. It's very much understood. So we're starting our conversations about what we're going to cover, not from, you know, how is everyone feeling, but instead we're like, okay, we know how we're feeling. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to, as journalists, best represent this issue? Should we take a more activist approach? And those are really the conversations we've been having. And I think at the end of the day, we as journalists of color realize that the burden is on us to represent these stories and to tell these stories in the most respectful and in most thoughtful manner possible. But at the end of the day, as journalists, we're also just trying to tell the story. And I think that's what we're doing so far. I think we're letting Detroiters tell their own story.
Bryce Huffman is a reporter at Bridge Detroit. His article, George Floyd's Painful Death, A Reminder of Detroit's History of Police Violence, can be read right now at Bridge Detroit. You can read his work and listen to the audio components at bridgedetroit.com. Bryce, thank you, and stay safe out there.
All right, thank you. I'm trying to stay safe.
And that's today's episode of Stateside. I'm April Baer. We will catch you next time.